has quite, I say, an ego. And he converted to Judaism. And then he went to Israel, and he lives now there in an illegal settlement of, I say, Ely. I don't know if I pronounce it correctly. It's quite Orthodox. And I would say, in the Netherlands, during his activism, he used the information of NG Monitor. And in a way, now he produces his own information at Honest Reporting, using the same tactic, guilty by association, checking people's social media, trying to find some what he considers evidence to smear people. And it's business as usual, like David says, it's tactic of people who support Israel at any cost.
Yes. I mean, David, what do you make of the New York Times employing three writers to cover Palestine who simultaneously have children in the Israeli military?
I mean, again, this is something we've seen a number of times in different programmes, that it's not just that they've had experience of the occupation army and presumably of human rights abuses, but they are actually doing it at the same time as a job for which there's a clear conflict of interest. Mm. And I don't think that the mainstream media organisations have got any conception of what they're doing here. This is a party to a conflict, and people can't be journalists and party to a conflict at the same time. It's a fundamental contradiction.
No, indeed. Certainly wouldn't have thought so. It's a very strange state of affairs. I mean, Adri, I mean, we also understand that a member of the CIDI's staff actually stood for the Dutch Parliament on the ticket of the far-right party for freedom, led by Geert Wilders. I mean, are there any other connections between the Israel lobby and the far-right in the Netherlands?
Yes. In fact, a few years ago, 2-3 years ago, two staff members of CIDI were a member of the Thierry Baudet's Forum for Democracy, which now for everybody is clear, it's an extremist right-wing party. And at the time we warned CIDI, you have those people in your staff, but you know, you are saying you are against Semitism, but look who you're working with. This party hates Muslims, and you're on the wrong track. So the links, but with the exposure of Thierry Baudet and his party, they try to cover up in a way and distance themselves from it. But the links with the PVV are still there. And there's a new party, a farmers party. And they're also right-wing. And now you see they shift to this party, to using it as a tool to pose their questions, to influence parliament with motions. So the links, I say, are quite strong. And you never hear Zionist lobby group about the settlement. And you know, when they really follow the agenda of the Israeli propaganda, like when we had the sad event that a Palestinian homosexual was murdered, kidnapped from Israel. Everybody, every pro-Israel activist says, oh, you see the Palestinians, but in fact, they don't give a damn about the rights of Palestinians. They're in fact anti-Palestinian, anti-Muslim. That's the agenda. And at times, it's quite sickening. Going back to the influence of Koningsfeld, the national broadcaster, NOS, appointed a correspondent for the Middle East, and her name is Nasra Abibala. So you can imagine what happened, honestly, for me. Same treatment like the photographer, but the NOS stood their ground, and there was a whole campaign on Twitter.
Well, Let's just pause there for a moment, Adi, if we may, because I just want to listen to this report on the role of the Zionist regime in running pro-Israel networks around the world.
We've got WhatsApp groups now that are run by the government, where we share information, working together.
These were the words of Gil Hoffman of Honest Reporting, revealing the close coordination between the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and nationally independent pro-Israel groups all over the world. But the strategic use of pro-Israel groups by the Zionist regime is not new. The Ministry of Strategic Affairs, or MSA, which had the lead role in the global war on the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement, created a network back in 2018. Here is the Jerusalem Post describing the network at an awards ceremony in 2019.
The Digital Network is a group of bloggers and social media experts established by Minister Ardan's Ministry of Strategic Affairs in March 2018. There are already 100 members from 20 countries around the world who together have a reach of about 15 million people in more than five languages. The network works 24/7 to defend Israel on the internet, to combat BDS, and attempts to boycott the world's only Jewish state.
At the awards ceremony, one can see Dutch lobby veteran Hidde van Koningsveld holding the Digital 19 placard. He was the author of the dossier which resulted in the sacking of the Gaza-based photographer Hossam Salim from the New York Times. He converted to Judaism and changed his name to Akiva to Judaize it, and now lives on an illegal settlement in occupied Palestine. The network has members in India, South Africa, Brazil, and many other places. All the key lobby groups are involved, including CAMERA, Stand With Us, NGO Monitor, and Honest Reporting, for which van Koningsveld works. UK members include operatives from the Nasha Jew troll account on Twitter, such as David Collier, as well as Simon Cobbs from Sussex Friends of Israel. One of the key tactics of the Zionist playbook is to lean in to accurate charges, as if to say, how ridiculous. They calculate that this is more effective than denying the truth. So the MSA producing publicity at their Digitel conference, proclaiming that their undercover Hasbro trolls. They even produced a birthday cake with a blue-haired troll on it. Zionist asset Simon Cobbs of Sussex Friends of Israel leaned into that, appealing for money to be sent to his groups, without revealing, of course, that they were already in receipt of ministry largesse. Meanwhile, one of the UK's best-known non-Jewish Zionists, the former arms lobbyist Luke Akers, follows the same script. Here he is on the left with close Zionist collaborators posing in their distastefully unique T-shirts. It's no surprise that Akers is also a member of the network, having attended the first conference in 2018 on behalf of We Believe in Israel. When they tell you it's anti-Semitic to say they all work together, remember, that is a lie.
David, I mean, has Gil Hoffman let the cat out of the bag on the coordination via WhatsApp groups of apparently autonomous Zionist organisations, do you think?
Well, he has, hasn't he? I mean, this is a private Zoom meeting, but it was obviously cast on the internet. And he said, yes, these are WhatsApp groups we have. They're run by the government. We coordinate. We work together. And, of course, this is what this digital network is for. And they say it very clearly in the film there, that this is a network. We all work together. And they use the same lines. And so, of course, they're going to be targeting Gazan photographers for the New York Times, or MPs for the Labour Party in England, or journalists in places and academics and others. So of course they're doing this in a way which is calculated and coordinated. And of course when you see the troll accounts in this country, for example, Nasher Jew and many others, this is a coordinated effort to target anyone who will stand up for the Palestinians. It's not something which they do because they're scared Jews in the UK or in the US. It's because they're there to work with, directly with, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs as it is now, and the Ministry of Strategic Affairs as it was then, in the Zionist entity itself. This is an overseas foreign policy strategy by the State of Israel. It's not any kind of an autonomous argument against anti-Semitism.
No, indeed. Adri, what about this guy Hidde? I mean, he was a guest of the Zionist regime in 2018 and 2019, I believe. Do you think people are aware of the network nature of the Zionist lobby?
The uneducated public, not but the activists, they are very much aware. There was a report published 2 years ago about the effort to limit the public space for speak about Palestinian rights. And it was very clear how the modus operandi was. NGO Monitor comes with information, it's taking up by CD, questions in parliament, pushing the minister to defund organizations like Al-Haq. I think it's very clear. Maybe not really the size of the network, but if you are really on a day-to-day basis busy with defending Palestinian rights, you know, I think it would be interesting if Dutch needs and would pay more attention to international. Because that's what CD tries to hide. Eh? It's like Center for Information Documentation Israel sounds very neutral, but the agenda is really different. And what I find frightening is that the board member is now appointed as the national coordinator to combat Semitism. He was in charge when all the stifling activists, academics happened, and Hidde van Koningsfeld was the one who really pushed for it. Yes. So it doesn't sound good.
Yes. I mean, David, the digital conferences were about creating an international network that could be used to coordinate activities and messages. I mean, do you think it's working?
It's working at one level. I mean, this is what we've seen for the last, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 7 years now. An attempt to coordinate attacks on supporters of Palestine and critics of the State of Israel. And they go after people. They dig up past things they might have said on social media. They distort the meaning of those things. And then they go to their employers and they try to get their performances cancelled or their jobs removed or their candidacy stopped. There are literally hundreds of these things happening. I mean, all across the world where they have people active. And you saw them bragging there about them being active in countries all over the world, in different languages, different huge numbers of organizations. And that's what they're all doing. They're all trying to make sure that they can target anyone who will stand up for Palestinian rights. So it's working at that level because many people, as you and I both know,
indeed,
have lost their positions.
Absolutely.
And that's happened in other countries too. But at another level, of course, they are panicking because they can see the writing on the wall. Even Israeli ministers have said this, that they might not be able to withstand the Palestinian resistance. And that, you know, as we speak, the Palestinian resistance is girding its loins for a major confrontation.
Indeed.
And this is something which we have been living with since last May, since a year ago last May, when the resistance in occupied Palestine beat the IDF and beat them back.
So we're
facing the possibility, I've said this before, of a collapse of the Zionist entity.
Yes.
And it might happen much sooner than we think.
Yeah. I mean, Adri, we've also looked into other key Israel lobby groups in the Netherlands, like Christians for Israel International and the Israel Product Center. I mean, what do you know about their operations?
Well, they are, of course, firmly rooted in the churches. And they are Zionists. They are linked. And the Christian product center was fined this year for their labeling the product from settlement as made in Israel. So there is a pushback in the Netherlands. But these groups, there's quite a lot of money. Some of their workers are living in Israel, or a past worker in Israel, in a settlement, the same settlement as von Koningsfeld lived in. It's really tough to deal with them because their agenda is clear. the settlements for them, it's the same as Israel. They are firm believers, and but their influence is limited to their own church. Yeah. So that's on the positive side. And there you come with Porcidi. They are a token of hope for Sidi, and that's the opportunism of the pro-Israel lobby. They grab whomever wants to support Israel, whether it's Orban or in the Netherlands, the Christian Zionists.
I mean, David, there were a number of UK participants in this network. I mean, does that mean they're likely to be working together and to be directed by the Zionist regime? Very briefly, we've only got about a minute left.
Well, yes, I mean, they are working together. We know this. I mean, we know that Luke Akehurst, who is, you know, is in the Labour Party, he's on the National Executive Committee of the Labour Party, poses as being some kind of leftist. We know that these people are working together with the ones who are more obviously rightist, the trolls like the National Jew, for example. They do coordinate, Sussex Friends of Israel, they coordinate as well. There's a clear coordination. They get money, some of these organisations, when the Ministry of Strategic Affairs was in operation, they got money directly from the ministry through various pass-throughs. So, yes, we know there's a coordination. But of course, as soon as we say there's a coordination, they shout anti-Semitism as if it would be impossible for them to work together.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there as we're right out of time. Thanks to Adrian Newhoff and to obviously our resident expert, Professor David Miller. We will, of course, be back next week at the same time. So please tune in then. As I say, we'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. A child is like a white paper on which you can write good things or bad things. Entire personality of a child is developed by the parents, by the upbringing they do. And in this program, we try to provide all the necessary information that is required to bring up your child in the best possible way. The answers of your questions are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al Mustafa University and researcher in the Hausa Alawiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor Nakavi, we have been discussing that how parents have to show off their emotions, how they have to show off their love through the emotions or the actions, because communication cannot be only through speaking. Speaking can be in many forms, in your words, in your body language, and that needs to be involving emotions and actions. I would want you to give us more examples, like how parents can show off this love to their children.
One of the issues that has to be taken into account is that basically the first faculty which is developed in a child is the listening skill.
Okay.
So a child, even in the womb of the mother, is capable of listening to things.
Yeah.
And the first stage in picking up any language by a child is also through listening.
Yeah.
Then goes on to speaking. Then he can start reading, and then he can start writing maybe at a later stage.
Yeah.
So in child development, listening is very important. And through that listening, his emotions and feelings are also invoked.
Okay.
The words that he listens to, the sounds that she listens to, they evoke many feelings.
Okay.
So that is important, what types of words and what types of sounds are coming to the child.
I was even reading a couple of days ago a study, a new research, wherein it was saying that even the child in womb reacts to what mother eats. Like if a mother eats carrots, a child smiles. Or if a mother eats, say for example, the brinjals, the child makes faces or something. So when a child in the womb can even react to these things, what mother eats, it shows us that a child has been listening and he has been definitely reacting to whatever he's listening, basically.
Yes, so when it comes to communication and talking, the first thing is listening.
Yeah.
He or she listens to words. Therefore, it's very much recommended that a mother recites the Holy Quran during pregnancy. That has a very beautiful effect on the child. So one of the things, as I mentioned, listening and feelings involved as a result. So we need to develop positive feelings, inculcate positive emotions in the child. So things which he or she listens to are very important. The words, even music, even singing, even whatever we are talking about, whatever sounds and voices, he or she picks them up. He or she is very sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at the child. He or she can understand in one what tone the words are being spoken.
Exactly.
He or she can very much understand if the parent or the mother is angry or is worried or is in a state of stress.
Okay.
So because it's of that listening capacity, that has developed to a very high degree.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to be very careful.
All right.
In what we say, in what we say, the choice of words. Let me give you something very important, which is very important in the sense that tomorrow when this child is going to develop into a grown-up, he needs to be able to communicate properly.
True.
The use of any language, in any language he or she communicates, he or she should be using the proper words, the proper sentences, grammatically correct, eloquent sentences.
Yeah.
And where does that start? From the womb, from the listening that the child is...
Charity begins at home.
...is exposed to at home.
Yeah.
So if a child, if a mother or parents don't know how to speak properly, even their own tongue, how do we expect the child to pick it up?
Yeah. I'll discuss more on that with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Nakavi. We are discussing how parents can educate their child through their emotions, through their actions. Well, Professor Nakavi, there are some parents who, at the age of very, say, 3 or 4, force basically their children, even Muslim parents, to actually pick up to basically... actually memorize Quran. Do you think that's okay?
In my humble opinion, no, that's not a good strategy at all. Basically, what has been very much impressed upon, emphasized in the various ahadith which we have, it is something common that we say that the Holy Prophet of Islam has very explicitly said that in the first 7 years of the child's life, there shouldn't be any formal education.
All right.
That's my understanding. When it's said that the child is a king in the first 7 years, he's a servant in the second 7 years, and the third, he becomes an advisor, a vizier. My understanding is for the first 7 years, there has to be no direct education.
No direct formal education.
Formal education okay. is out of bounds. Yes, there has to be learning, but it should be completely informal.
Okay.
Putting the child into a classroom environment and making him learn.
Putting pressure on him, basically.
Pressure to do it, it's completely incorrect.
Yeah. I was just.
It should be done, if you want him or her to pick up the Quran, provide him an environment where he or she is listening to the Quran. And
because
he or she will
basically first
he will listen. And how do you? I mean, you see that many of our children, they pick up songs, they pick up a lot of
any other music
when they hear songs, music,
the pop, the classic,
whatever type of music, this listening is so effective that they pick up, memorize those things in a natural way. It should be done in a very natural way. If I want my child to pick up the Quran with a when we teach children ourselves or even employ some teachers to teach them, many of the teachers even don't have the proper accent to teach them Arabic.
Exactly.
But if you, for example, a child is exposed to continuous, audio listening, videos.
He may
games,
learn very soon.
He himself will pick up the rhymes, the nursery rhymes. How does a child pick up the nursery rhymes?
True. We'll discuss more on that after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "He who has a child must treat him in a childish manner."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Naqavi. We're discussing how parents can educate their children through their emotions and actions, which are extremely important as a communication, as a part of communication, as we say, speaking. The speaking is an important skill in the same way. Showing that love through your emotions and actions is actually equally important. Well, Professor Naqavi, you were saying that a child should not be forced. Let me tell our audiences that I was just talking to a psychologist yesterday who said that we had a case and there was a guy who was elder, who was like in his 20s, and his parents came and they were upset with him because they said that he would go out at night, take out a car and only move around the roads. He won't listen to music. He won't be picking up anyone. He won't be going anywhere. But he would just be roaming around on the roads. And then when they verify the case, what has actually happened, the psychologists come to the point, go back to his childhood, and then they realize that the child was forced to memorize Quran at the age of 4. And since that, he was given a very formal and tough education at a very, very early age. He missed a lot of things, and now this missing thing he was finding in the roads, and which even he could not find in the later age. So you also recommend our parents that not to do that.
Exactly. The problem, you know, what is the problem out there? But the problem out there is that our parents are very much concerned that they, especially our expats who are living in the West.
Don't you think, Max, many of them want to do it for the show-off?
Show-off is important. That is what I'm coming to. That's what I'm saying. They are very much concerned with their identity as being Muslims.
Okay.
And they think that being a Muslim, a good Muslim, is being able to recite the Quran properly. Yes, it is a part of it, but it's not all of it. That's a compartmentalization of religion into very some specific things, as I've been saying from the beginning.
Okay.
Islam is not just reciting the Quran and offering prayers properly. That's one part of our
that's being good human. That's important, but that's a part of
but
it.
But that has become the identity of, that is what the identity which we want to identify ourselves and our children. We say, oh, let our child finish off the Quran at that age, and we start, we have a Bismillah at the beginning, and we at the end we have a program.
And the society will be praising us.
And if the society doesn't, if he does so, if he's able to recite the Quran off by heart, everyone will be praising, and look how good a Muslim parent I am. That sure. is the problem.
So basically, you're doing that for yourself. You have to be very much concerned that whatever you're teaching to your child, that should be for the child himself, not for your own praises and other things that are not for any kind of show off. Thank you so much, Professor Naqvi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio or our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanallah. God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. His Holiness Muhammad and Prophet of Allah, peace be upon him, and his pure progeny has said, I leave among you the Thaghalain, the Book of Allah, and my Itra. Verily, they will be inseparable from each other until they join up with me at the pool of Kauthar. Selfish people and followers of Taghuts abuse the Holy Quran as a means by which to establish anti-Quranic rules. To achieve this mischievous target, they force off the scenes the true interpreters of the Quran, as well as those who have received all of the Holy Book directly from the Prophet, and their ears still echoed with the voice of His Holiness Muhammad, who declared, I leave among you the Thaghalain.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the prayers. In one of his speeches, he said that sound prayers drive away obscenity and vice from an ummah. In this part of his speech, basically, he's referring to the verse of the Quran where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said, إِنَّ الصَّلَاةَ تَنْهَى عَنِ الْفَحْشَاءِ وَالْمُنْكَرِ, that this prayer, if the sound prayers are offered, it drives away the obscenity and the vice, the fahsha, obscenity and the vice. Obviously, we know that when we pray, we are standing in front of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. What he wants to say is, he says that these prayers, these sound prayers, it takes away, it drives away these two things from an ummah. And obviously, when we talk about the social life, we are talking about the Muslim ummah as a whole. Generally, when we read this verse, we talk about the, or we have an idea about the individual life, that individually, a person's life will not have these two things if he has sound prayers. But on the other hand, Imam Khomeini is mentioning another way, and he's pointing out something else, and he says that, no, it does not have an effect on the individual life as well as it has an effect on the society, on the ummah. Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi. Now imagine that if a person goes to the mosque 5 times or 3 times, no matter, and he offers 5-time prayers, and there he meets his Muslim brothers and sisters. Therefore, he will shy from them when he is about to perform obscenity, when he is about to perform some kind of thing which is vice. Therefore, he will stop himself in front of people. We see that in Islam, there are many things that have individual effect and the social effect. Where, for example, the issue of hijab, basically it's an obligation from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the way it is about the prayers. But obviously, if someone is not observing hijab in the house, but when they come out to the society, they have to do that. Similarly, a man who needs to have the hijab or the veil of his eyes and not to look at namahram, when you have a sound prayers, it has not only effect on your individual life, but as well as it makes an ummah a perfect place, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, every night.
la ilaha illa Allah.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing European security polarization and the new Cold War against Russia with Professor Heinz Gärtner from the University of Vienna. But first, this brief analysis.
Decades of aggressive eastward expansion by US-led NATO towards the borders of the Russian Federation following the collapse of the Soviet Union and the aftershocks of the Russian invasion of Ukraine have led to a dramatic security polarization in Europe, not seen since the height of the Cold War in the mid-20th century. The dreams of a borderless Europe from the Ural Mountains to the Atlantic Ocean seem very naive these days, as a hard border is being established between the Russian Federation and neighboring European countries, with a dramatic increase in the level of militarization on both sides, which, if history is to be guide, will not be dismantled very quickly once it's firmly established. Even the previously non-aligned countries of Sweden and Finland have joined NATO. It seems the old British plan of preventing a strategic alignment between Russia and Europe, and particularly between Russia and Germany, is once again being implemented. However, this time this effort is being led by Britain's American cousins, who inherited the British Empire following World War II. It's precisely in the period of the so-called American unipolar moment in the late 1990s and early 21st century, where the world witnessed the aggressive expansion of NATO towards the western borders of Russia. The instrumentalization of Ukraine, the weaponization of Ukrainian nationalism against Russia and Russian speakers in Ukraine, and the threat of Ukrainian NATO membership was the final straw and repeatedly stated red line that pushed Russia to take preemptive military action against NATO expansion into Ukraine. The severe reactions and sanctions by the Western countries against Russia have led Russia to strategically reorient itself towards the east and southeast, towards China and Iran. This has been very beneficial for Eurasian integration and particularly for boosting Iran-Russia relations, and it represents a very significant historic and geostrategic shift. But the question remains whether it's in the national interests of European countries to have bad political and economic relations with Russia. Is it really in the interests of many European nations to sanction and vilify their most important energy and raw material supplier and one of their largest export markets? Despite historically high inflation, the threat of closure of major industries, and exponential rises in energy costs, brainwashed Atlanticist European elites continue to repeat the anti-Russian propaganda designed in US and NATO think tanks, contrary to what many of the citizens believe, which is neutrality and non-alignment based on the real, tangible interests of nations. Of course, the people of Europe have so far received their reply from their elites. As, for example, when the young, inexperienced German foreign minister proudly announced that helping Ukraine is more important than what German voters want. It remains to be seen how she and her party will fare the next time German voters get to vote on what they want. Cracks are already appearing in the European facade as nations such as Hungary and Serbia are trying to take an independent position based on their national interests vis-a-vis Russia, as well as countries such as Austria, who are warning about the consequences of unilateral energy sanctions and trying to moderate the anti-Russian rhetoric. But in general, it seems that nearly all European elites have once again shown their geopolitical impotence and inability to form policies independent from US and NATO diktats. As we head into this year's cold winter in Europe, we will have to see how much the European people are willing to sacrifice from their high standards of living in the pursuit of this new Cold War against Russia, which has divided Europe and forced a major historic and geopolitical realignment in the world, and which, contrary to US and NATO propaganda, does not appear to be in Europe's long-term interests.
Professor Heinz Gärtner, Professor of Political Science, University of Vienna, thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
You're welcome.
When we heard that you're coming to Tehran, we asked you to come join us in person for this interview. You kindly replied to this request, so here we are. We want to talk, as you know, the program Insight is really a program where we try to look at things strategically. We try to get a deeper understanding of what's going on. And one of the major issues of the world today is what the events that are happening in Europe, particularly the events that have now occurred with the war in Ukraine. And it seems that there is a new security architecture, a new security structure, a new reality that has descended upon Europe, a reality which in many ways is very similar to the Cold War. You have this hard border again being drawn between Europe and Russia. You have countries that even during the Cold War, like Finland and Sweden, who weren't part of NATO, are joining NATO. But here we have to then look at really again this bad faith that we see from the West and from the Americans, which is so you have this Ukraine after the Soviet Union, which has a significant Russian-speaking population, culturally Russian population. And then they do the Maidan coup. They bring in these neo-Nazi groupings that are part of this coalition. We don't want to say that they were the main people, but they were a significant part. And you change the constitution. They get rid of the Russian language as part of the constitutional rights of the Russian people. You have the civil war starting in 2014. So, yes, I mean, your point is well taken that that this would have been a good situation. But it seems to me that the last thing that the Americans or NATO wanted is a Ukraine where people are living together in peace. They actually were provoking the Russians in many ways with the attacks that they did particularly on the Russian population. And then when the NATO membership was mentioned, again, we are trying to analyze. We're not trying to justify or to agree or disagree with whatever decision was made in Russia. But it is understandable from an analytical perspective, if the Russians felt like there was no other option left for them, because they tried all the political options, and it seemed, whether it was the Minsk agreements, whatever, all the other political and diplomatic formulas and ways to deal with this, they saw it was not happening. And maybe this is something going back to the essence of Ukraine. You have this country being created, as you mentioned, and Henry Kissinger mentioned a long time ago, that you have actually two
March
Ukraines.
2014.
Exactly. that you have actually two Ukraines. It's not one country. You have this Ukraine in the West, which is Catholic and much more culturally closer to Poland and that part of Europe. And then you have the East, which is culturally closer to Russia. So what I want to say, because you mentioned these very interesting things. So what you're saying is that essentially we've had this historic turn, this historic event happening, where Russia is separated from Europe, where it separated itself, if we want to analyze it from that perspective, or the Europeans decided with the Americans to separate themselves from the Russians. In Iran, of course, we would say that this was good for us, because then Russia came towards the Asian side, came closer to China, became closer to Iran. As we see, there's very extensive, an increase of relations between Iran and Russia in this time. So maybe geopolitically for Asia or Eurasia, this was better. But again, my question is it really in the national interests of a lot of these European countries to have this cordon sanitaire, this hard border? If you look at Hungary, it's trying to have some sort of an independent policy with Russia. It's not, in terms of, at least rhetorically and in terms of the way they speak, they are being a little bit more cautious in terms of their relation with Russia. You see even Austria, in many ways, trying to maintain its neutrality within this idea of what's going on, this alliance building, as you say. We see, of course, Serbia, traditionally a natural ally of the Russians, culturally close to the Russians, basically saying that they will not join NATO, no matter what. So again, my question is, as a European, I'm asking you, is it really in many of these countries, particularly those who are closer to Russia, who are maybe dependent in terms of energy and gas and coal and raw materials, is it really in their interest to be in a Cold War and a kind of a non-relation state with Russia?
Let me make two points. First point briefly. I don't have. I don't think we don't have that much time anymore.
No, go ahead.
So to Ukraine. I have to say, Russia was not really fond of neutrality either. So Russia said that I would be in. They would support a non-NATO membership of NATO, which was credible, I would think. Every Russian president repeated that. But they did not really speak about neutrality. They didn't really, because that meant the Russian supported militias in the east.
Right. That means Russia would also have to.
Well, Russia would have. It would be an example also for Moldova and Georgia, where you have Russian troops or peacekeepers. So it would be a model for others as well. So the Russians would not really support neutrality. And I have to say, if Ukraine would have become neutral, it could get its territorial sovereignty and territorial integrity back. So it's a unified, you mentioned it's divided. The Russians might have speculated that they want somehow keep the eastern part.
Right.
But if there would be a neutral, would have been a neutral Ukraine, all foreign powers would have to leave, and Ukraine would have the possibility, like Austria, to create its own identity. Right. Sovereignty.
In other words, nobody wanted a neutral Ukraine, neither NATO and neither
unfortunately,
Russia.
Unfortunately, you're right.
Exactly.
Some supported it, like Henry Kissinger and Jamie Oppenheimer as well. They came later as well with the suggestion. So there are some pundits who really thought that it might be the best. But politically, you're correct. Politically, you're correct. So your second point, do the Europeans really want to have this divided Europe? So, and I have to say no. So
exactly.
Because now Putin brought war, and Putin and NATO brought the division of Europe back, like in the Cold War, but that was our starting point. Now it plays out like in this polarization. We have a division of Europe, cordon sanitaire. It even goes to the cultural level. So
it's ridiculous. Some of the sanctions are ridiculous. Sports, culture, opera singers,
arts, science.
It's ridiculous.
To talk to Russian scientists.
We were joking in Iran that it's even worse than the sanctions against Iran, which we thought would never happen.
I don't know whether I could speak on Russian TV like I speak here. So we have this new coordination there, and it will last decades. And the Europeans cannot want to have this.
Exactly.
So they have to think about it, maybe not immediately, but we do have concepts from the history which it could be applied.
So let's talk about that a little.
So I just mentioned two of them.
Right.
So one is because I'm coming from Vienna. We had the Vienna Congress of 1815. Exactly. We had the Napoleonic Wars, and then the victory powers would sit together, and they would ask France to come to the table a little bit later on as well, and created an order for Europe which was peaceful first half a century, and then we had this wars of unification, another Crimean war. But then it lasted another half century after the first war. So it was based on balance of power, at the same time on liberal concepts, common values. I have to say, there were all colonial powers. So the interventions in the south, that was permitted.
Exactly. That was the
caveat of this.
Exactly.
But for Europe, it was not such a bad concept to sit together and to avoid another war, which was successful, at least half a century, you can say.
Right.
Then you had this war. So Europeans should think about it. Is this type applicable, to have a big conference when the war is over, to think about it? We have to somehow bring in Russia back to Europe.
Right.
Like Europe did it after the Second World War with the Marshall Plan. after the First World War, they isolated Germany.
And didn't work.
The result was Hitler. The Nazis, no?
Exactly. So after World War II, they had the Marshall Plan trying to bring it.
And then the second concept I would like to mention is during the height of the Cold War, we had a conference on security and cooperation, the Helsinki Accords of 75. And this was an interesting concept. Height of the Cold War, we had the arms race. Of course, we had at the same time the German Ostpolitik and also the the down politic by President Nixon. It was all a global context, of course. But it was the Helsinki conference. And if you look at the Helsinki documents, they do not mention the words enemy, foe, competitor, rival. Right. If you look at the security strategies right now, they're all full of this. And why? And it speaks about common security, cooperative security. And why is it interesting theoretically? So we talked about the security dilemma before. Because security, if we make a decision, security, the other one would react somehow. That would be, I increase my security, and the other would feel it offensive. And so the idea was not to increase the security, but to lower the threat level.
Exactly.
A common security is the opposite of the security dilemma.
Right.
Common security was also the idea of the Palme Commission later on.
Right.
Willy Brandt, Palme, Kreisky, so they had this, this idea.
Yes.
So this lower the threat and not increase my military capacity.
And they were all social democrats. Olaf Palme, Willy Brandt, Bruno Kreisky.
I have to mention this. The one who really prevented a neutral Central Europe in the 50s, according to the Austrian model, there were ideas, Western pundits, not just Stalin. So it was George Kennan as well. It was Labour Party leader Hugh Gaitskell. It was the bipartisan initiative, Noland Humphrey from the US. They all said, Rabatsky Plan, Polish foreign minister, they wanted to create a neutral Central Europe, a nuclear weapon-free, with the inclusion of Germany. Germany would be unified, but it would be also Czechoslovakia, Poland, Hungary would not part of the Warsaw Pact. So the one who really was opposed it was Konrad Adenauer, etc.
Right.
But I have to say, the father of Austrian neutrality was also a conservative. It was Julius Raab. So
there was
a conflict between Adenauer and Raab. So I had to mention this because you said there were social democrats.
Maybe we can do a program on Austria one day.
No. I know. The time is
no, that would be interesting one. We should do it one day.
But I said, Europe, let me summarize. Europe have to think about concepts which go beyond this division. Otherwise, we will have this
sanitaire. But it seems to me the atmosphere, the public atmosphere, it really is not conductive right now. Any politician who would even mention these things right now, they would, they would hang him up,
That's definitely...
This is a problem, isn't it? I mean, we have a situation where you had this massive propaganda campaign, and it's interesting to me because, Europeans in general, on the average, are much more, conscious, aware, educated, have more information about the world than maybe American public has. So maybe one can understand if the Americans want to, apply this propaganda to their own population because their own population is very ignorant about the world. But the Europeans don't seem to be, are not that ignorant. And yet we see this massive propaganda campaign still going on. The idea that somebody would come out and say, look, we need to talk to the Russians at some point. This is not in our favor. It seems to me this is almost an impossible thing to propose right now as a political figure or as a public figure.
Unfortunately, yes. But it might change if Europe will feel the effects of the war and if they will learn about the casualties. So they're not different than Americans. If you see casualties all the time and refugees and... So it over time, if a war goes on for too long, it might change the attitude. But on a global level, because you talk about the European citizens, now we have this war situation, which is a very special situation. And in a war, you have always this with me or against me. You have this
it's black and white.
So there's no place for a complex, as we did, complex analysis.
So we have to start.
So, right. But let's just mention one thing that was an